Welcome to this Main Street on this Tuesday, the next to the last day of 2025. I'm Eric Deatherich. Of course, this is a time for reflection upon the last 12 months. We are not immune to end-of-year lists. Mike Olson, host of Into the Music, has one later in the show. His five favorite records of the year. You'll definitely want to put an ear to that. Take down some notes and add them to your collection, digital, physical, or otherwise. But first, for our monthly Philosophical Current series, the guy that has the coolest walk-up music in the world.
Happy or content? What a good life really means, and we hear a lot about happiness, how to find it, how to measure it, how to optimize our lives around it. But many people, when you ask them what they really want, don't say happiness. They want to say contentment. So what's the difference? Is one different than the other? Is one better than the other? Have we misunderstood what either of them really means? And of course, it's time for Philosophical Currents, and our friend, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein from the University of North Dakota, he's going to help us sort through that. And Jack, it's a pleasure to have you on what will be your last appearance in 2025 on Main Street.
I am happy to be here. I am happy that 2025 is over, although I am not content with getting older. So,
yes, there you are. And it's always careful what you wish for, Jack. You just don't
exactly
know.
Right.
All right, let's get our bearings here, Jack. When philosophers talk about happiness and contentment, are they talking about the same thing, or are those two things fundamentally different ideas?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there because there are a lot of assumptions that we make, not only about the definition of those two things, but of the context and the background. So, for example, most people think of happiness and contentment as emotions, and I think contentment probably is. When people think about emotions, they often think of themselves as distinct from reasons, as distinct from justifications, that you can't argue yourself into being happy, for example. You can't be persuaded to be content. And I think in that instance, contentment has more of a connection to argument than happiness is. But let's take a step back for a second. And the tradition has messed around with the definition of happiness in a variety of ways, and lots of people consider it a form of pleasure. And so the early hedonists defined happiness or pleasure as the absence of pain. But what's the ultimate absence of pain? Death. So they decided that death was the perfect happiness, and people started killing themselves. So they reversed the definition. And now pain is the opposite of pleasure. And therefore, you know, death is the opposite of happiness. And now people don't want to do it. Definition solved. But the idea behind that is that happiness is a feeling, it's a sensation, it's an intuition, it's, as we would say now, chemicals reacting in the brain in a certain way, dopamine, serotonin, these sorts of things. But Aristotle comes along and says, happiness is not a feeling, it's a doing. And I think we've talked about this before in the show, that the idea is happiness is a pursuit of, he says, the function of human life, but we can be more general, the pursuit of the things that we think are valuable, the pursuit of the things that make us better, more virtuous, more capable people, as opposed to other things. And again, the examples that I would have used in our discussion are training for athletic event. When people are running 20 miles, they aren't necessarily feeling pleasure, but they may be happy. And when people are suffering through the first few months of having a newborn and they're exhausted and the mother's body is tired, they may not be experiencing pleasure, but they're experiencing happiness. So happiness is something larger, and it's a procedure, and it's a lifelong thing. Contentment is a response to the context that you find yourself in. And contentment says, is this good enough right now? Am I relaxed? Have I achieved what I want? Do I need anything else? No, I don't. And so contentment is a moral judgment about how much effort you need to put in and how much is enough, in a way that happiness is not, because happiness is a much larger thing. Interestingly, you don't need to be happy to be content, and you don't need to be content to be happy.
And that's what I wanted to ask you, Jack. I look back at the roller coaster we call 2025. Great times, tough times, everything in between. And you remove all of that, and there were times that I was very happy, but I'm not sure whether I was content. As I look back on my life, I feel that I'm content, but not always happy. So you say that you can be happy without being content. You can be content without being happy. Where does that fit for us? You must have to have some happiness in your life to be content.
Again, it depends on how we're using the terms, but also the circumstances in which you're answering the question. So, for example, if I am the victim of a flood and I have spent all day trudging through the rain and the mud, and I find an empty barn with bales of hay, and I get into the hay the hay loft, and I'm warm and I'm dry and I can sleep safely, you could say at that moment that you are content. But I doubt you would say you are happy. And this actually leads to a very interesting discussion in economics, because one of the ways that economists try to evaluate whether people, the quality of life of people, is their satisfaction. How satisfied are they at any one given moment? The problem with this is, and this is an example that the economist, Nobel Prize winning economist Amartya Sen puts forth. He was a guest on the show, by the way, on Why, that if you are a mother in rural, poor India, and everyone needs all the calories that you can afford, you give the sugar to first your husband, who has to work, and then the kids, and then yourself. And the mothers often don't get sugar in their tea. So one day someone comes along and says, I'm going to give you a pound of sugar a week. And all of a sudden you have tea with sugar. Your satisfaction level has increased exponentially. But that's not a reliable indicator of whether you have a good life. You're poor, you're struggling, and your life is so precarious that a bag of sugar can make such a big difference. So satisfaction is relative in that sense. Contentment is relative in that sense. And I think you and I, right, we are in professions in which there is a clear model of what the elite is. You know, I could be teaching at Harvard. I could be teaching at Stanford. I could be teaching at the Sorbonne. You could be
at CBS.
At CBS, right? Okay, you know. But I look at my 25 years at UND and say, I did good work. I raised a family. North Dakota was pretty good to me. Maybe on some level, there's part of me that might want to work at those institutions, but frankly, I'm content here. You know, I'm UND gives me what I need, and I'm content. It doesn't mean that if an opportunity didn't fall at my feet, I wouldn't take it, but I'm content. And if I retire from this job, I will be able to say that I had a job that I found fulfilling and worthwhile. I think the same can be said for you, as much as I know you, but yeah, you should speak for yourself. That's contentment. And what you imagine, someone, two people, one person's unhappy and one person's content. Unhappy, one person is discontented. If you walk up to the person who's unhappy and you say, you should be happy because you have a beautiful child and you have a secure job and there are no earthquakes. We were talking about this before the recording. There are no earthquakes where you are. You can't make someone be happy. You can drug them up and give them euphoria, right? You can give them a high, but you can't make someone be happy. But if you walked up to someone and said, look, you have a healthy child, you have a good family, you have a reliable job, there are no earthquakes, you can exhale for a while and say, this is good enough. You can persuade someone to exhale in that way, whereas you can't persuade someone to change their fundamental values and their holistic sense of who they are and what they want and what's important to them. Happiness refers to that. Contentment refers to momentary, contextual, individual, special circumstances.
And thinking about this, Jack, I thought about two things. First, society, I think, puts enormous pressure on us. Our culture puts enormous pressure on us to be happy. Every ad that we see, the end game is for us, it seems, to feel happy. From your perspective, from a philosophical perspective, is that expectation healthy, realistic?
I want to use a sort of strange example here for a second because I want to talk about a kid's cereal.
Okay.
We have taught, you know, certainly our generation has taught our kids, don't use drugs, drugs are bad, they're addicted, blah, 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 right? The putting aside the legalization of marijuana the last, you know, 5-7 years, the central message of life from the 1970s and 80s was abstain from drugs, you know, as Nancy Reagan said, just say no. There was, and probably still is, a children's cereal called Trix. And Trix used to advertise with a bunny. And the bunny's sole desire was to get the cereal. And the bunny would trick and lie and manipulate and was desperate to get the cereal because eating the cereal would make them euphoric, that their raison d'etre would be fulfilled. And there was actually, Cocoa Puffs had another version of that, the bird that went cuckoo for Cocoa
Puffs. Cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs,
right,
yeah.
Exactly right. How can we tell our children not to want drugs when the model of a good children's cereal is addiction? And is addiction to such an extent, the desire to get high, a sugar high maybe, but still high.
And happy, just, perhaps.
And happy, to such an extent that you will sacrifice every moral virtue and everyone you love to do this. We teach our, we tell our society to be happy, but we teach them to want things that make them unhappy or that undermine that. Another example, just, you know, we're having conversations about Jeffrey Epstein and Harvey Weinstein and we are very, very clear that sexual activity and sexual desire for 14 and 15 year olds is illegal and immoral. But every 14 and 15 year old on television is wearing, you know, the young women are wearing midriffs, Disney and Nickelodeon. They don't have ugly kids. They have attractive kids. And we're not supposed to encourage age gap relationships, but every movie we see, you know, a 25-year-old woman with a 45-year-old man. Those of us who were old enough to remember who Bob Dole was, when Bob Dole was running for president, he was in a commercial for Pepsi where they showed a Britney Spears dance where she's, you know, again, scantily clad, midriff, all that kind of stuff. And they cut to him, who's about 84 in the video, and he's holding a pencil in his hand because his hand doesn't work because he's a veteran. And he says, wow. And pardon the graphic image for some of our listeners, the pencil is erect. The pencil is a phallic symbol. The pencil is a sign of how he is supposed to feel about this young woman. So every single message we get as to the things we're supposed to want are things that our culture also tells us we're supposed to feel guilty for wanting, or we're supposed to deny ourselves. We, and here I'm speaking specifically about America, but every country has its problems. We have constructed a society in which we are operating on desire and acting on denial. And that can't be a society that promotes happiness. And it doesn't promote happiness in the satisfaction sense, in the emotional sense, but it also doesn't promote happiness in the sense that we're not going to be healthy, we're not going to be virtuous, we're not going to have strong senses of ourself. So I think the society tells us, to answer your question that you asked 4.5 hours ago, tells us that if we are not happy, we are not good people, but provides only the mechanisms by which we can desire things we don't or can't have, and thereby undermines that happiness and does not help us achieve what we should achieve.
Undermines contentment, perhaps, as well. Jack, let me reintroduce you to our listeners. Jack Russell Weinstein is my guest. We visit monthly. Our little segment here is called Philosophical Currents, but Jack is also the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, a monthly program aired right here on Prairie Public. Jack, I read in The Atlantic now a couple of weeks ago a story by Arthur C. Brooks, and essentially he was saying, I think, that some thinkers argue that peace and happiness come not from elevating ourselves, from wanting more, from being, perhaps, realizing how small we are in the grand scheme of things, finding relief and even comfort, recognizes our own smallness. And that seems to be able to bring contentment rather than despair. I don't have enough. I need more. I'll never get there. Oh my gosh. No. You're a speck on a speck.
There, I think, is an element of truth to that, in the sense that we have to be realistic about the world we live in and who we are and what we have. And I should not expect, as a philosophy professor, to own a Ferrari or even to cure cancer. Right? I like to joke that I want to write a book that is so good it wins the non-existent Nobel Prize in philosophy. Right? I have to know that's a joke, right? I have to understand what the limitations are. But at the heart of that argument is a cultural and, frankly, very Christian notion that desire is destructive, and that what we need to be is ascetic, minimalist, and know our place. And I think that that's problematic, because part of what makes human beings so miraculous, so wonderful, so challenging, is the constant pushing to open up the world. Where would we be? I was just in Italy getting my daughter, who was on a semester abroad at college, and we're bringing her home. And where would we be if Michelangelo had not made the David? Where would we be if he had not painted the Sistine Chapel? If someone said to him, Michelangelo, you just paint the pretty boys that you look at every day. Don't overstrive. And we constantly have conversations. As a philosophy professor, my students often say, well, this question can never be answered. You know, you're asking me a question that will never have an answer. And I always say the same thing. I say, we don't know that it will never be answered. Just like we have to say, we don't have the cure for cancer yet, as opposed to we don't have the cure, cancer can't be cured. There's no reason not to say in philosophy, we can't, I don't know, prove the existence of God yet, or we can't come up with a definitive human ethic that is respectful of animals. We haven't done it yet, but maybe we can. And so, to what extent the human animal is designed, is constructed to be the discoverer, the explorer, the creator, the inventor, that our essence is to make things larger than ourselves. In my experience, and of course, I think this varies greatly, but in my experience, if I were not part of that project, I couldn't be happy. And that's one of the reasons why I love teaching so much, because forget the books that I write or anything else, I have important impact on many, certainly not all, students' lives. And every year I get what I call the five-year email. And the five-year email is the student who said, you may not remember me, I was in your class, it was so important to me, and I wanted to thank you, and I think about it all the time, and blah, 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 blah. And often it comes from students that I wouldn't possibly have imagined that I would have had that effect. I had a student who was a rugby coach, I think it was rugby, and he talked about how he figured out how to be a rugby coach by remembering the things we talked about in class. Right? If you take away that desire to be larger, if you take away that desire to be more, if you say human beings should recognize that we are specks and we should be happy with our place in the world, what that does is deny the fact that all of us have the potential of increasing the world, healing the world, putting love in the world, even if that may only involve our neighbor, a friend. I'm sure many of your listeners will have this experience too. There's at least one person on our block with a snowblower. And so some days we walk out of the house to shovel and they have snowblown the entire block, right? And it's just such a nice thing. It's such a thoughtful gift to just do the whole block. That person isn't curing cancer, but they're making us bigger and larger. And they're giving.
They're making our world, as small as it is, still a better place.
That's right. And so that's my reaction to that sort of celebratory of smallness.
So, Jack, we have a couple minutes left, and I want to talk to you about community, actually, because we've talked about it before. And of course, we live in rural North Dakota. People, I think, value steadiness, routine, and community. And do you think contentment then is more closely tied to those values than happiness is? And do we really have it better than we think right here?
Community is incredibly important. Community is incredibly important for virtually all human interaction, whether it's having shoes, right? Because it takes 500 people to get the leather, bring the leather, make the threads and sew it all together and blah, 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 right? So human beings, always community oriented, but human beings also need companionship. They need love. They need the ability to judge what's right and what's wrong. And they have to see other people in that way. But also that community just makes the day-to-day life nicer. My best friend, Gail, is currently visiting. She lives in New York. She's a retired New York State trooper. We met, I was a sophomore in high school. She was a freshman in high school. We met in French class and we have been best friends ever since. I was the maid of honor at her wedding. She was the man of honor at my wedding. And we've always lived very far away from each other, except for a very short period of time. And she's here and I'm just having a blast. I'm in a better mood. I struggle, as many of our listeners know, with depression. And I know that I would be less depressed if Gail lived near here instead of 1,500 miles away and $700 plane tickets away, right? My daughter is here on break and I don't even have to talk to her, just be in the same room with her and I'm happy. So community is incredibly important, and we can feel that way about our friends. We can feel that way about our kids. We can feel that way we had a neighbor for years who tended a really beautiful garden. And sometimes I just stood on the porch and took pleasure in watching her garden, right? Because it was so interesting. Do we have it better than we think we do? I think in most instances, there are a lot of things that we probably ought to be more appreciative of. I think the risk in that approach is to say, you should be appreciative of what you have, so you shouldn't expect or feel entitled to other things. So for example, you feel safe in your town of 300 people. But just because you feel safe in your town of 300 people doesn't mean you aren't entitled to a better school system or entitled to maybe a more robust medical clinic, more diverse peoples to bring an interesting new restaurant, or having your kids connect to other parts of the world, right? What it means to live fulfilled in our world, and that's a word we haven't talked about yet. What it means to live fulfilled in a world is a robust notion that involves the pursuit of happiness, not necessarily happiness, but the pursuit of happiness and contentment. I think the question becomes, when we are content, what can we do for other people? Because then we have the room to help others be content and to create more fulfilling human experience for everyone involved.
That's Jack Russell Weinstein. He and I visit every month here on Prairie Public. Our segment's called Philosophical Currents. And Jack, of course, is also the host of Why philosophical discussions about everyday life, a monthly show right here on Prairie Public, a program that features philosophical discussions with a wide variety of really cool guests. Jack, thanks for joining us, Jack, and Happy New Year to you.
Thank you very much. Happy New Year to you. Here is hoping that 2026 is the single best year in human history.
Yep, cheers to that. It's Jack Russell Weinstein in conversation with Craig Blumenschein for this month's Philosophical Currents. I'm Eric Detheridge, pinch hitting in the hosting chair for Craig today. Coming up in just a few minutes, Mike Olson, host of Into the Music on Prairie Public, shares his five favorite albums of 2025. Stay with us.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota is no stranger to a scientific effort known as cloud seeding to minimize the impact of hailstorms, but regional researchers said a broader set of data is needed to guide future decisions and better protect communities and property owners. Here's Mike Moan.
The University of North Dakota says for several decades, the state's project has allowed pilots to fly into selected storms and release tiny particles into the clouds. That way, there would be many small ice particles instead of fewer large hailstones. In the western half of the state, this approach was meant to reduce hail damage to crops. UND's Marwa Majdi says the time is right for her team to see what's working and what isn't.
It will then help communities to understand what the evidence supports and whether hail suppression efforts are actually reducing the most damaging hail.
Majdi says these questions increasingly arise when an intense storm harms livestock, homes, and local businesses. She emphasizes UND values collaborating with the state on this weather science. Nationally, this has been a hot-button issue with online disinformation fueling theories that the government controls the weather for political reasons, prompting the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in 2024 to debunk several claims. Majdi says by providing clear and independent information, decision makers can determine how to reshape this program, giving agricultural towns the best tools in their fight for economic survival.
That can mean more stable farm income and fewer catastrophic losses.
UND says when a hailstorm results in extensive damage, communities face higher repair bills and insurance costs. Project officials say part of their effort will involve looking over a detailed database of storms from 2016 to 2024. An AI system will also be developed to aid this scientific work. If they get all the funding needed, researchers hope to provide study results 4 years from now. This is Mike Moan for Prairie News Service.
And the State Board of Higher Education has hired an outside auditing firm to look at certain accounting practices at Dickinson State University. The board met in executive session to consider the matter. After that session ended, Board President Kevin Black said questions had been raised about what he said were certain accounting practices. Black said the firm of Clifton Larson Allen was hired to conduct an independent compliance investigation to assess processes and controls to assure they align with policies and standards.
The State Board of Higher Education and the North Dakota University System is taking this opportunity to review certain accounting practices to ensure clarity, consistency, and compliance. This is both a backward and forward-looking review intended to determine whether there were any policy violations and to provide an opportunity to strengthen systems moving forward.
Black said the board takes this matter very seriously. No further details were offered. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation in partnership with Strengthen ND, announcing the 2025 Bush Prize North Dakota honorees, TNT Kids Fitness, and Hip Hop and Hope. More at strengthenND.com. You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Eric Detheridge, pleased to be joined by my colleague and the guy that literally gave me my first shot in radio a few moons ago, Mike Olson. And hey, Mike, you're with me to share five of your favorite albums from 2025. First of all, was there any scientific criteria for this?
Not at all. In fact, the whole concept of best of the year lists and stuff like that, that's not really what this is. I'm just kind of shining a light on some recordings that I thought were good and probably deserve a little more attention.
All right, so we don't have any flowers or golden statues to hand out or
anything
like that.
Nope, not on this one.
It's not a popularity contest. It's just sort of what, you know, piqued your interest this year, right?
Yeah.
So let's start off 2025's favorite picks from Mike Olson with something that's always near and dear to your heart, the blues, and an artist that is on the famed Alligator Records label. Make it on my own.
Yes, I'm grown now. That's right. I'm talking about D.K. Harrell. It's his second record that he's put out now, but the first one for Alligator Records. Really a nice recording. And the reason I wanted to highlight D.K. is because blues is challenged by, they need young talent to keep it going. And DK is that way. He's very talented as a guitarist. He's compared often to the three kings, Albert King, B.B. King, and Freddie King.
Well, B.B. was his hero, right? I mean, he worshipped B.B. King.
B.B. King is a hero, and it's hard for me to listen and not hear Albert King's influence on his singing. And he's able to write songs that are not only great blues songs, but also have a sense of humor in the way that, you know, many of them do, in the way that somebody like Albert Collins used to do, where his songs were quite entertaining as well. You know, and if you're a fan of the blues and you're looking for somebody new to discover, I would point you towards D.K. Harrell.
And the album is called Talkin' Heavy, and that's that sense of humor, too, because he's a big guy.
He's a big guy. That song, you know, though, is also talks about kind of some of the heavy circumstances that are out there in a blues man's life. D.K. Harrell was homeless for some time, not that many years ago. And so he's got a lot of cred in that way, too. And he's felt the blues.
Let's hear a little bit of that title track right now.
Lord, I'm talking heavy.
All right, next up, Mike, an artist that popped up on your list last year and one that you noted has kind of morphed from a rapid-fire jam band style way of playing to something more controlled, more melodic. Of course, we're talking about the bluegrass superstar Billy Strings. Talk about bringing young people into the bluegrass fold. Like, you know, the blues is looking for young stars. Billy Strings is that star in the bluegrass world. He released a collaborative record with a guy called Brian Sutton. First of all, tell us about Brian Sutton and this album that they teamed up for, Live at the Legion.
Okay, so here's the backstory on this, is that years ago when I was just graduating out of high school, I think, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band put out a record called Will the Circle Be Unbroken? And that was my first exposure to Doc Watson. Okay, Doc performed a song called Tennessee Stud on that record, and a number of others did flat picking. And I was really attracted to that, went out and found, became, you know, a big fan of Doc Watson's music, got all his records. And of course, Doc influenced many, many people, including people like another bluegrass legend, Tony Rice, who plays a style of guitar called flat picking, as opposed to finger picking or something like that. And a flat picking style, they play fiddle tunes, can be a lot of fast picking. Tony Rice emerged from that, Russ Barenberg and others. Brian Sutton kind of took up that mantle and was one of the great talents in the flat picking world for years working out in Nashville. He was kind of like for Alison Krauss or people like that, he'd be Ricky Skeggs, he'd be one of the first people called to play the flat picking guitar. Okay, well, so then we go along and Tony Rice died and there was kind of a space in the bluegrass world and two really great young talents emerged, Molly Tuttle and Billy Strings. And Billy Strings, of course, his backstory is one of these, you know, it's kind of a J.D. Vance story, even more so. His father OD'd from heroin. He was... His mother and stepfather were on meth and living in a trailer with no heat, no plumbing, no water. But what they did have is his stepfather had a great love of the music of Doc Watson.
From Will the Circle Be Unbroken to Full Circle, really.
And the thing about it is, these guys really love Doc Watson's music. And you can hear it. As soon as I heard Billy, not in a jam band setting, but as soon as I heard him play actually with his stepfather around the campfire.
He's bringing everybody along for the ride,
and
too.
He loves the music. He loves playing. You can tell every time you hear him talk. Well, anyway, so one of the people, one of his peers as a flat picker is Brian Sutton. It's somebody that he really admires that's out there. And so they went to the Legion, which the Legion, I got a chance to go to the Legion. The Legion is an American Legion club.
East Nashville, right?
In East Nashville. And on Tuesday nights, they had, for 9 years, they had Honky Tonk Tuesday night at the American Legion. And I got a chance to go there, and it was a trip. I mean, this was like, it was just like walking into a club from like 1957 or something like right. that.
Okay, so it's a live at the Legion, a live record, Brian Sutton and Billy Strings. Let's fade up a song that showcases their playing in harmonies here. What should we play?
Well, we could do Walk On, Boy.
Walk on down the road. Now there ain't nobody in this whole wide world that's gonna help you carry your load.
Walk On Boy, a Doc Watson tune, is performed by Brian Sutton and Billy Strings from their new album, Live at the Legion, one of Mike Olson's favorites from 2025. Bluegrass and the Blues coming on strong this year so far, so that's great.
Sure.
So speaking of that, we have an uber-talented, North Dakota-born, rural Minnesota-raised singer, songwriter, guitarist. I mean, just a great voice. She knows her way around a hook and a line, if I ever heard one, in country music. We're talking about Brennan Lee. The album is Don't You Ever Give Up On Love. First, for those that don't know Brennan, we all should, for being around here and be very proud of her, tell people about Brennan Lee.
Well, Brennan and her brother started playing as teenagers, and they grew up in a home where there was country music, like the old school. Their parents liked the old school country music, Ernest Tubb and George Jones. They grew up playing together. Brennan became a very accomplished guitar player. Her brother was a mandolin player. And so they got their start doing country duo stuff and got a little old-time bluegrass and songs. Well, they went down to Austin, Texas, and eventually Brennan in particular became a big part of that Austin music scene down there. Brennan has the knack. And in fact, on this new record, she's got completely solid songs.
And there's a lot of cheating going on, a lot of infidelity. And I think my favorite one is called Dumpster Diving. You know,
right?
I mean, I just love the line from that and the title.
So Brennan's story was she, is a fine singer, performer. She's recorded with Asleep at the Wheel. Her career has just continually progressed. And she is she's worked with Charlie Crockett a lot over the years. Mm-hmm. And in a way, her career has progressed in a fashion. I mean, Charlie's really exploded now, but she is performing music on her own terms, doing what she's liked. And that's why I've always, I've got a lot of respect for Brennan in terms of what she's been able to do
and what she continues to do. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
She's worked with great people. I mean, Chris Scruggs, she is a great Nashville musician that she works a lot with. And, she's just doing it the right way and has been able to do it progressively. I've picked Brennan's records several times now at the end of the year list.
Yep.
And, Brennan is a little side note here. Brennan turned me on to Melissa Carper, who is another artist that's much like Brennan, who is another person that's got the knack. She can write song after song after song that are really good songs. They had a nice Christmas record this year, actually. But so Brennan's got this new one. You're right. And I don't, I'm not sure what's gone on in Brennan's personal life, but this song is is, well, it could be the break up and recover, up and moving on.
I sense a theme, and you'll hear why here in a minute. But
It seems, I would agree. It seems like there's a theme there.
Yeah, maybe 2025 is the year of the breakup record. So aside from Dumpster Diving, what other song do you want to highlight from her new record, Don't You Ever Give Up on Love?
Oh, let's see here. She's got one called You're Finally Hurtin'.
All right, let's listen to that one.
Like I knew you would be, after all your deserting and forgetting about me. I knew she'd step out eventually. For your love, it's curtains. You're fine.
Like country, you know, and the old honky tonk Tuesday nights was perfect for Brennan, you know, because
so you could have your own honky tonk Tuesday night by putting on this record by a North Dakota born artist,
absolutely
so talented. Don't You Ever Give Up on Love, Brennan Lee. Well, all right, Mike, I gotta say, I was delighted by your next pick. Lily Allen is one of the most, I think, underrated artists of this century. Remember that album, All Right Still? That was kind of her first record.
Absolutely.
It's a classic. It's a banger, as they say. It is London-themed record. It's like sort of the comic response to London Calling. It had reggae on it, ska, and just like, I mean, just in the humor, the wit of Lily Allen was just absolutely hilarious. It makes sense because her dad was a comic, Keith Allen. So like that humor always has made sense with Lily Allen. I've always bought into it. I've loved it.
Lily had two daughters and left the music business. You know, Lily was a worldwide sensation, but she really kind of backed away from the music business so she could raise her daughters. I checked up on Lily through YouTube. There's this Architectural Digest has a series on YouTube where people invite you into their homes.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, so who's on there but Lily Allen and David Harbour?
Yeah.
And
actor from Stranger Things, if you don't know. Yep.
Yeah, and they had, I didn't even know they were a couple, but they were and had married and moved to New York and bought a brownstone in New York and had architects in and designers, and so they walk you through their place, and, you know, it's quite a tour. And I thought, you know, and then you're just observing Lily as she takes you through her dwellings here. Well, so this new record is called West End Girl. And the opening song invites you into her story. And in many ways, I actually think that, like, if there was going to be an album of the year, this could be it as far as artistic accomplishment.
Be back in London for rehearsals in May. And later that evening, you said, how was my day? I said, I got some good news. I got the lead in a play. That's when your demeanor started to change. You said I'd have to audition. I said you're deranged. And I thought that was quite strange. And I thought that was quite strange.
She really invites you into the pain and heartbreak. And what ended up happening is Lily had to go back to Britain. She got a job in a play, acting in a play. And she received a phone call from David Harbour, which is, she incorporates into this record. And he basically was informing her that he felt that he had to have an open marriage, and there was a lot of infidelity and apparently sex addiction and a lot of things that get unrolled in this record.
Hi. How are you? I miss you. Yeah. Huh? Yeah. All right. Okay. Well, I mean, it doesn't make me feel great. Well, if that's what you need to do, then...
Yeah, you know, it's an unraveling of a relationship, but I think anybody that's been through something like that can totally relate to it. It's just naked in its honesty.
Yes.
And that's one of the things that's appealing about it.
And all of the different emotions that she goes through as she progresses, you know, as you go through this record. It's a real journey with her.
I mean, it makes me really sad, but...
All right, we're up to Mike Olson's fifth pick in no particular order, we should mention, for his five favorite albums of 2025. And no surprise here, Mike, because I know you're a fan, and maybe you saw his Tiny Desk concert recently. It's just absolutely uplifting and life-affirming. 73 years old, but yet he can still dance, and he looks just alive and vibrant as ever. Of course, we're talking about David Byrne. Everybody.
You say with gesture and expression in my imagination.
That's right.
So who is this guy? That's the name of the album. I think it's one that we all sort of needed for 2025. What do you like about this record?
I like a lot of it. And it's David. You know, it's been 13 years since David put out a record of new songs. And he's been very active. He's had a play on Broadway. It's American Utopia. He's had a lot of things going. David seems like a person who's got a lot of irons in the fire, always very actively involved in the world. But he came back. He apparently he had writer's block for a long time during the pandemic.
Right.
Stayed in his apartment, tried to live life and figure out what it all meant. Well, he's back now, and he's another guy with a sense of humor. David is probably as happy or happier than he's ever been. This is a happy record. It's funny. It sounds like vintage David Byrne is what it does.
Well, even like, you know, something as mundane as putting moisturizer on your face sounds interesting in his
right,
hands.
Right.
My love gave me a moisturizing thing. Said, hey, David, put this on your skin. It says it's anti-aging.
Well, he's always been that way, you know, but he notices. And this the band that is backing him, the Ghost Train Orchestra, is very interesting. David has always, you know, found interesting musicians to work with. I want to just draw your attention to it.
But I am still me. My honey wakes up. She looks over and screams. That lotion is magic.
Well, all right, good way to end it. There you have it. Mike Olson's five favorite albums of 2025. You can hear Into the Music with Mike weekdays from 9 to 10 a.m. Central, and then again from noon to 6 on Prairie Public's Roots Rock and Jazz stream and app and on the radio in several of our cities across the Prairie Public Radio Network. Michael, thank you for the tunes. We could all use some great music to get into, so thanks for your picks this year.
Sure.
I might look like a baby, but inside I'm a man.
Hope you enjoyed hearing about Mike Olson's five favorite albums of 2025. I'm Eric Dethridge in for Craig Blumenshine. If you're listening during the 3 p.m. broadcast, All Things Considered with your local host Danielle Webster will be up next. Dry January, well, Gen Z is already there, drinking way less booze than their predecessors. So what could that mean for the club and live music business? Find out on All Things Considered. If you happen to be catching us during the 7 p.m. Central broadcast, Kelly Corrigan Wonders. Great conversations with Kelly and her thought partners. Well, that is coming up in just a few minutes. Stick around. Dakota Datebook is up next. I think by most objective accounts, 2025 was a pretty tough year. So here we are, about to close the chapter on this one and open up 2026. Is there cause for optimism? Always. Well, here's a story that's yet to be told, but can you just imagine if this transpires? It can. Despite the elimination of federal funding and the shrinking and shuttering of public radio stations across the country, listeners have stepped up. The efforts to destroy public media have failed. Now, wouldn't that be quite the story for 2026? Well, it can be if more folks join people that have already said, hey, no way, you're not taking away my public media. Join them. Go to prairiepublic.org and make a donation of any amount. And thank you for powering Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 30th. The Civil War was not going well for the Union in 1862. A victory at Shiloh in April was followed by defeat in the Seven Days Battles, an inconclusive result at Antietam, and a disastrous loss at Fredericksburg. President Lincoln searched for a general who could match Robert E. Lee's skill while keeping an eye on the nation's future. In May, he signed the Homestead Act, allowing all Americans, regardless of race or gender, to claim land in the Trans-Mississippi West and build homes. But Lincoln wasn't done. On this date, in 1862, Lincoln finalized the Emancipation Proclamation and circulated it to his cabinet for review. The proclamation took a bold step toward fulfilling Thomas Jefferson's words that all men are created equal. While it did not free all slaves, it declared that all persons held as slaves in rebellious states are, and henceforward, shall be free. Lincoln's action transformed the war's purpose from simply preserving the Union to ending slavery and breaking the bonds of the past. The conflict became a war for freedom. The Emancipation Proclamation was not perfect. It applied only to states in rebellion and depended on Union military success, but it marked a historic step forward. Freed African Americans who migrated to Dakota Territory helped lay a foundation for future generations. The Homestead Act offered the chance to claim land on the Great Plains, while territorial law prohibited kidnapping and outlawed slavery as a criminal act. New arrivals faced discrimination in education, business, and politics, but they persevered. The Freedmen's Bureau provided critical support, assisting with homestead claims and establishing schools. It also helped create churches, fraternal organizations, and mutual aid societies, supporting the development of strong communities. The determination and perseverance of newly freed African Americans contributed to the demographic and economic diversity of what would become North Dakota. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that is it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. I'm Eric Etheridge. Thanks for hanging out with me today. It was a pleasure to hang out with you. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Rick Guillon shares his top five favorite moments from his weekly feature, Prairie Plate. It's all about food and the people who make it in our region. So make sure you join us for that. In the meantime, have yourself a great rest of your Tuesday.